Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews 10. Just by way of introduction to Hebrews chapter 10, it breaks down into three parts. The first part of Hebrews 10 is doctrinal, and that'll be chapter 10, verse 1 through 18. This section continues the thought that we were looking at in chapter 9. It kind of flows right on from chapter 9. Chapter 9, remember, was talking about Christ's sacrifice. And chapter 10, you'll notice, begins with the word for. So it connects it back to chapter 9. We're going to be talking about the same subject for a while, and that'll be the first 18 verses. And after we finish verse 18, we will be ending the first major section of the book of Hebrews that we called the doctrinal section. It's been very heavily doctrinal so far in the book of Hebrews. When we get to the end of verse 18 of chapter 10, we're going to see a switch. And the switch is going to be to the practical section. So it'll begin in verse 19 with an exhortation. Look at Hebrews 10:19. It says, "Therefore, brethren," and that "therefore" hinges back on all the doctrine we've learned. It's going to assume that we've digested all that doctrine, that we know what he's been talking about, and he's going to go on to make a call to perseverance in faith. Now remember, that was the problem the Hebrews were having. They had become believers, and they were being tempted, so to speak, to go back to the temple worship system. They were being maybe intimidated to go back to the temple worship system. At any rate, they were considering going back to the temple worship system. And this section of Hebrews is going to be a call to persevere in your faith. The practical section. And in chapter 10, it starts with an exhortation, then goes to a warning. In chapter 10, 26 through 39, it's one of the five warning passages of Hebrews. Look at verse 26, for example. A very popular verse where it says, "For if we go on sinning willfully after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a terrifying expectation of judgment and the fury of a fire which will consume the adversaries." So a very severe warning passage in the last part of chapter 10, and we'll get to that next week. Chapter 10 is also going to introduce us to the subject matter of the rest of the book of Hebrews. It's going to introduce the ideas, and then the rest of Hebrews will follow along. For example, in chapter 10, verse 22, it says, "Let us draw near with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith." And that full assurance of faith is going to be the subject of chapter 11. Remember, chapter 11 of Hebrews is often called the faith chapter in the Bible. It's going to talk about men of faith, heroes of faith. And then in verse 23 of chapter 12, it says, "Let us hold fast to the confession of our hope." And that is going to be the key to chapter 12. Look at chapter 12 and verse 2, for example, where it says, "Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, for those who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despising shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." It's talking about hope or future things, things that are future to the believer. And then in 10:24, where it says, "Let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds," that'll be the key to chapter 13. chapter 13 will be an exhortation to love. 13:1 says, let the love of the brethren continue, and so on through the chapter. So with that set before us, let's go back to chapter 10 then, and we'll look at it in detail. The first thing we're going to have, chapter 10, verse 1 through 18, will deal with a problem and a solution. There'll be a problem, and then the author will tell the solution to that problem. The problem is stated in verse 4, and the problem section of Hebrews 10 is verse 1 through 4. But the problem is stated in verse 4, where it says, for it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. That's the problem with the Old Testament system. It's the problem with the temple worship system, the Levitical priesthood. There's a problem with that. The problem is that the blood of bulls and goats cannot take away sin. So the Old Testament worship system could not deal with the real issue. Look at verse 1. It says, for the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come. So the Old Testament system cannot deal with sin. It just was never designed to do that. Now the author is going to give four reasons why the Old Testament system can't deal with sin. First, because it was a shadow, not the real form. Verse 1, we just read, for the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come. And the end of verse 1 says that it's powerless. It says, it can never, by the same sacrifice which they offer continually, year by year, make perfect those who draw near. It doesn't have the power to do that. It's powerless. It was repeated, not final. Verse 2 says, otherwise they would not have ceased to be offered. Otherwise would they not have ceased to be offered? Because the worshipers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have consciousness of sins. So if it could deal with the sin problem, it would have done so and been done with it, but it didn't. The sacrifices were continual, repeated. And lastly, he's going to argue that the Old Testament system brought a reminder of sin, not forgiveness of sin. Verse 3 says, but in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins year by year. So it's a reminder of how sinful man is. The solution to this problem is going to be given in verse 5 through 18, and we'll get to that a little later. But the solution is going to be very simple. A perfect sacrifice. A sacrifice that can take away sin. So problem, solution. Now, let's look at the problem in detail. In verse 1, first thing the text says about it is that it's a shadow. It says, for the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come. The word shadow is the Greek word skia. Skia is, they use the word shadow pretty much like we do. It's shade caused by the interruption of light. That's what a shadow is, right? And two important things can be said about a shadow. First, just say, for example, can I get a shadow here? Can you all see that shadow? If I hold my pen like that, you can probably tell what that is, can't you? By the shadow. Can you tell what brand it is? You can't see the brand. That's marked on the clip. Can you write with that shadow? Can't write with the shadow. It's the pen. That's the idea of the Old Testament system. It was a shadow, an outline. So, two important things about a shadow. One, it lacks detail. You couldn't see what brand of pen that was because there wasn't enough detail. All you had was an outline. And two, it lacks function. You can't write with a shadow. Verse 1 goes on to say, that the law was a shadow and not the very form of things. Not the very form. The word form is the Greek word icon. Almost everybody in America knows what an icon is now because computers have become so prevalent. An icon is a recognizable image. So Christ is the very image of God. And it's recognizable. It's detailed and it's functional is the idea. Look at 2 Corinthians 4. We have that same word. In 2 Corinthians 4:4, and it says the same thing there. It says, in whose case the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving, so that they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Same word there. Christ is a recognizable image of God. He is a detailed image. Colossians 1:15. Stop there on your way back to Hebrews. Colossians 1:15. Again, the word translated image again over here in verse 15, it says, He, that is Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. So the law, back to Hebrews then, only gives us an outline of the things to come. Christ is the reality of the things to come. In Hebrews 9:11, it says, but when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come. He's the real deal. He's not just a shadow. He's the real thing. And that's the idea of chapter 10 and verse 1, is that the law was a shadow. Christ is the reality. Now notice in verse 1, there's a link made here. And that link is between the law and the sacrificial system. Because it's talking about sacrifices. Look, verse 1 says, for the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very form of things, can never, by the same sacrifices, which they offer continually, year by year, make perfect those who draw near. So the law, the Old Testament law, the Mosaic law, is inseparably linked with the sacrificial system. The sacrificial system was all bound up with the law. It was part of the law. Now, not only can the commandments then, and we tend to think of the law in two parts, don't we? The commandment parts and then the sacrifice parts, the sacrificial parts. You can't separate those because the sacrificial system is part of the law. It was ordered in the commandments. You can't separate those two. Nor can you separate one part of the law, the commandments, from another. Look at Galatians chapter 3. And I'll explain why I'm going through this in a moment. You can't separate the commandments from the sacrificial system. Nor can you separate the commandments from each other. Galatians 3:10, it says, for as many as are of the works of the law are under a curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law to perform them. So you can't take the law like a loaf of bread and slice it up into pieces and say, well, I'll take this piece, but I don't want that piece. The law comes as a whole. And that includes the sacrificial system. Now, why am I going through all this? Well, simply to mention that if you put yourself under the law, the Ten Commandments say, is that part of the Mosaic law? Sure it is. Can you separate the Ten Commandments from the rest of the Mosaic Law? Can you separate the Ten Commandments from the sacrificial system? You can't do it. It's all part and parcel. It's the Old Testament way. So if you put yourself under law, you better start raising bulls and goats because you're going to need them. Because the law and the sacrificial system are all bound up together. And you can't take them apart. Now, to answer your question before you ask it, no, that doesn't mean you can do anything you want to because you're not under law. Because we're under grace. We're still under a system. It just isn't the law system. The next thing the author of Hebrews mentions about the Old Testament system, the sacrificial system, is that it was powerless. It could not make perfect those who draw near. Now, make perfect is the Greek word teleao, and teleao means to bring to an intended goal. And this is according to a standard Bauer, Arndt, and Gingrich's lexicon. It's to bring to an intended goal. What was the goal of the priesthood? We've studied this before. In case you don't remember, I'll tell you. It's threefold. Threefold goal of the priesthood. One was to take care of the sin problem. Two, to bring man into fellowship with God. And three, to keep man in fellowship with God. Those three things are the purpose of the priesthood. Now this verse 1 says that the sacrificial system, the Levitical priesthood, could not accomplish that purpose. Verse 2 goes on to give evidence of that, where it says, otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered, because the worshipers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have had consciousness of sins. That's the main proof that the author of Hebrews uses to point out the deficiency of the law. And we've had it over and over again, haven't we? If the Old Testament sacrificial system was effective in taking away sins, how come they had to do it all the time, continually? The Day of Atonement came every single year. It never stopped. So even though the Old Testament system was divinely commanded, it could not fulfill the ultimate purpose of a priesthood. And you know what? It was never meant to. What was it meant to do? Well, it was meant to point to the perfect sacrifice that was to come. It was a blueprint of the perfect sacrifice that was to come. So we should have that really in our back pockets by now, that the Old Testament system was deficient, and the proof of that is because they offered sacrifices year after year after year. Kind of like a rain barrel. You know, it slowly fills up. Once it's full, you dump it, and then what happens? It starts filling up again. That's how the old system worked. It filled up. On the Day of Atonement, it got emptied, but then throughout the year, it filled up again. Have to empty it again, year after year after year. That's how the Levitical system worked. Verse 3 and 4 says that it brought a reminder of sin, not forgiveness of sin. Verse 3, but in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sin, year by year. For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. So the sins on the Day of Atonement, remember, atonement is a word that comes from an Aramaic root that means to cover, kafar. Sins were covered on the Day of Atonement. They weren't taken away. That's why every year it was repeated, and every year everyone was reminded of their sins. Now, the reason it couldn't take away sins is stated in verse 4. It's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. So, with that in mind, when we look at verse 5, What is the solution to that problem then? Well, the solution is the perfect sacrifice. So in view of the problem, verse 4, what's going to happen is Messiah will volunteer to become the sacrifice, and that volunteer is important. He will volunteer to become the sacrifice, and in doing that, he's going to set aside the first system, the Levitical system. He's going to establish the new. So it's going to talk about a change in the way God deals with man. A change in, we call them dispensations. So we talk about this perfect sacrifice. Where did it originate? Whose idea was this anyway? Well, it originated in the mind of God the Father. Verse 7 says, Then I said, Behold, I have come in the scroll of the book. It is written of me to do your will, O God. So God the Son says, I will do your will to God the Father. So the idea was God the Father's idea. Verse 9, then he said, Behold, I have come to do your will. Again. So God the Father is the one who decides what the provision for sin will be and who the provision for sin will be. God decides this, not us. And we like to think up our own ways to have fellowship with God, don't we? We like to say, well, boy, and I like to use this one, I'll go sit in a metal chair in church for 2 hours on Sunday and listen to Jim drone on, and I won't even fall asleep. God is bound to have fellowship with me because of that, because I suffer so much. God doesn't work that way. We can't come to Him on our terms. We can only come to Him on His terms. He's the one who chose what the sacrifice will be. He's the one who chose who the sacrifice will be. So when it comes to salvation, we have to approach God His way, not our way. Now, who executed then this perfect sacrifice? Well, it was Jesus Christ. That's verse 5 through 7. Therefore, when He comes into the world, He says, Sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, Behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, to do your will, O God. And we notice the to-dos in here. In verse 7, I have come to do your will. And in verse 9, I have come to do your will. So the one who executed this plan is Jesus Christ. It finds its source in the mind of God the Father, and it's executed by Jesus Christ. Now, let's look at the nature of this sacrifice. And the first thing we note, it was voluntary. And we've had this in the verses we just read. I have come to do your will. It's important that it's voluntary. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because of God's attitude toward sacrifices. Look at verse 5. It says, Sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you have taken no pleasure. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means the Old Testament sacrifices alone did not have any power. God was never pleased with a sacrifice, and we see that in the Old Testament, without the obedience from the one who was making it. Look at 1 Samuel 15. We'll just look at a few examples of this. It's not the sacrifice itself, it's the mental attitude of the person making the sacrifice. Gee, does that sound familiar? That's always been the way God operates. He's not interested so much in our good works as in our attitude behind those good works. 1 Samuel 15, 22. Verse 22, Samuel said, "Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams." So, obedience is what God wants. Psalm 50. We'll work our way back to Hebrews and look at a few examples. In Psalm 50, starting down at verse 8, it says, "I do not reprove you for your sacrifices, and your burnt offerings are continually before me. I shall take no young bull out of your house, nor male goats out of your folds. For every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on 1,000 hills. I know every bird of the mountains, and everything that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you, for the world is mine, and all it contains. Shall I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of male goats? Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and pay your vows to the Most High." See his reasoning? God says, "I don't need bulls and goats. I own the whole world. It's mine. You think I really need this stuff?" What he wants is obedience. He wants a mental attitude. Now back to Hebrews. See the importance of this sacrifice being voluntary? It wasn't just the idea of the sacrifice, it was the idea of a mental attitude behind that sacrifice. And Jesus was, his obedience was perfect. In verse 7, it says, "Then I said, Behold, I have come, in the scroll of the book it is written of me, to do your will, O God." So we've had verse 5 and 6 talking about how God is not doesn't really want the sacrifices, but the mental attitude behind it. And in verse 7, we have, "Then I said, Behold, I have come." And that word "then" is an adverb of time. What it means is at that time. It's immediate. God says, "I don't want the sacrifice, I want the mental attitude." Christ says, "Then, at that very time, I said, Behold, I have come to do your will, O God." So his perfect sacrifice was matched by his perfect obedience, his perfect mental attitude. And not only that, but it was complete. Philippians 2. His obedience was immediate and it was complete. Philippians 2:8, "Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." So his obedience was immediate. It was complete. Perfect obedience. Now back to Hebrews. What then are the results of the sacrifice? That's the last part of verse 9 through verse 14. Verse 9, the last part says, "He takes away the first in order to establish the second. By this will, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all." So first, it changes the covenant under which God relates to man. It takes away the first, it says in verse 9, it takes away the first in order to establish the second. So things have changed. God does not deal with man on the basis of animal sacrifices anymore. And if you admit that, then you have to admit that the animal sacrifices and the law are all bound up into one system. And then in Galatians, you have to admit that you can't break the law apart either. So when he set aside the first, or took it away, what did he take away? Just the animal sacrifices? No, the whole law is gone. God does not deal with man on the basis of law anymore. He deals with man on the basis of grace. That's possible because sins have been paid for. Because we have the perfect sacrifice. Verse 10 says, by this will, that will refers to the will of God the Father, the one that Jesus came to do. By this will, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. So the will of a loving God is to save sinful man. And that's something the sacrificial system could never do. We had that in verse 1 through 4. That's the whole problem. The word sanctified here, the word hagiazo, and when we think of sanctified, we think of a process usually, don't we? But that's not what he's talking about here. The word sanctified in its basic sense means to set apart for God. Now we can look at that in terms of a process of the Christian life, but here he's not. He's looking at the salvation of Christians. And the reason I say that is because it's a perfect participle. And a perfect tense, remember, talks about what? Past action with abiding results. So at some point in the past, believers have been sanctified. That's when Christ died on the cross. A perfect participle is the strongest way of showing permanent, continuous state. It was once for all. See the difference between the Old Testament system? This is once for all. Now in verse 11 through 13, the author makes a comparison, and the comparison is between the temple priests and Jesus Christ. First, the temple priests covered sin. Jesus removed sin. Verse 11, every priest stands daily ministering and offering time after time the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. So the temple priests did not remove sins. Couldn't do it. Verse 12, but he, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God. The Old Testament priests, continually sacrificing, working down at the temple all the time, once a year they had the Day of Atonement, year after year after year. Jesus Christ was a once-for-all thing. Now note here, that the sacrifices are still being offered in this verse. It says, every priest stands daily ministering and offering time after time the same sacrifices. Now that tells us something about the book of Hebrews. It tells us that it was written before 70 AD, because in 70 AD the temple was destroyed by Titus and the 10th Roman Legion. So this, it was still in operation when this was written. And that'll be important when we get down to verse 26. That'll be next week. So sacrifices still going on. Every priest, notice it says in verse 11, every priest stands daily ministering and offering. You know, there weren't any chairs in the tabernacle. Not a one. There wasn't any place for the priest to go sit down. But Jesus, on the other hand, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God. Priests, the temple priests, are still standing because they're not done. and they can never be done because their priesthood can never accomplish taking care of sins. Why did Jesus sit down? It wasn't because he was tired after a hard day's work on the cross. It was because he was finished. That's why he sat down. His sacrifice removed sins. It didn't need to be repeated. He could sit down. So he is waiting until the time is ripe. That's what we call grace. He's waiting for the last believer in the church age to believe. And then things are going to change. And Jesus Christ will return at the right time. And when he does, it's not going to be to suffer. Why not? That's done. He's done with suffering. He's going to return to reign. So verse 14, the position of believers is secured. It says in verse 14, "For by one offering he has perfected for all time those who are sanctified." So the position of believers is absolutely secure because his sacrifice was sufficient. Again, the word perfected, that's the word teleao. It's the same word we had back in verse 1. And that described in verse 1 what the law could never do. Remember, verse 1 says it could never make perfect those who draw near. Well, in verse 14, his offering has perfected for all time those who are sanctified. So it says for all time. Salvation is permanent. Now verse 15 through 18 is a prediction of the perfect sacrifice. And the argument here is simple. The argument the author of Hebrews is making is simply that the Old Testament predicted this. You guys are operating under the Old Testament system. Well, the Old Testament system predicted that it would be set aside. He's quoting Jeremiah 31, 33 through 34. And in verse 15, he says, "And the Holy Spirit also testifies to us, for after saying, 'This is the covenant that I will make with them after those days,' says the Lord, 'I will put my laws upon their heart, and on their minds I will write them.' Then he says, 'And their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more.' Now where there is forgiveness of these things, there is no longer any offering for sin." So the perfect sacrifice was predicted in the Old Testament. So what the author of Hebrews is saying, if you deny the perfection of Christ's sacrifice, then and go back to the Old Testament system, well, you're denying the Old Testament system because it predicted that sacrifice. So the conclusion, verse 18, what's the conclusion? There's no longer a sacrifice for sin. Why? Sins have been paid for. When Jesus Christ died on the cross, he paid the penalty for every sin, past, present, future. It was the perfect sacrifice. It solved the problem that the Old Testament priesthood, the Levitical priesthood, could never, ever solve. Now this completes then the doctrinal section of the book of Hebrews. And next hour, when we start with verse 19, we're going to switch to an exhortation. And we'll pick it up there next hour. Father, thank you for the book of Hebrews, this amazing book that we're studying. Thank you for sending the perfect sacrifice for sins so that we can be sanctified forever, for all time, because of that one sacrifice that paid the penalty for all sins. Father, thank you for sending your Son to die to do that. It's in His name we pray. Amen.